Welcome to a podcast of Beyond the Book, a presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center. Copyright Clearance Center is the world's largest provider of copyright compliance solutions through a wide range of innovative licensing services and comprehensive educational programs for authors, publishers, and their audiences in academia, business, and research institutions. For more information about Beyond the Book and Copyright Clearance Center, please go to www.beyondthebook.com.
I'm Georgia Higley, and I work at the Library of Congress, and it's a pleasure for me to moderate this program on copyright in the 21st century. This program is being sponsored today by Thomson Scientific and Dialogue, and I don't know if there's any representatives from them here in the audience, but I do want to say a big thank you on behalf of the news division for their support of this program. Just before we get started, if you have questions during the course of this program, please feel free to ask them. You don't need to wait until the very end. So the only thing that we ask is that you use the microphone that's located in the center of the room because this program is being recorded. Okay, copyright in the 21st century. Not so long ago, copyright protection meant a little copyright symbol on the title page verso and a warning posted over a copier. Since those days, much has changed, and there's changing in the meaning of the word copyright. What does the future hold formally and functionally for copyrighted content and copyright holders? Many people and organizations have grappled with this very question and have, through the web, attempted to organize and communicate some of the intricacies of copyright issues. That is so that the average citizen can become aware of the importance of copyright in everyday life. The U.S. Copyright Office is located at the Library of Congress, and its staff have put together guides and information product packets and databases to assist those who want to copyright their creations. The office also is open to citizens and organizations for guidance and commentary regarding potential revisions to the copyright code, such as the current issue of orphan works, so that the creative works of individuals are sufficiently protected without discouraging new creative efforts or making such material publicly available. For those of you who may just be learning about copyright, there's a lot of material available on the web. Stanford University has created the website Copyright and Fair Use. The University of Texas has what they call a crash course in copyright. Duke University has a Center for the Study of the Public Domain. And the copyright website has gathered information on some noteworthy cases dealing with copyright relating to movies, music, information, the web. And they even offer what they call a fair use equalizer to help determine potential infringement or fair use. And those are just drops in the bucket, really, for what's out there. And we also have the Copyright Clearance Center. The CCC has become a forefront in discussing and grappling with copyright issues and the balancing act needed for creators and the public. So we're really fortunate to have a representative from the Copyright Clearance Center, like Bill Berger, to take a look at the future of copyright. Bill is the Vice President of Marketing at the Copyright Clearance Center, and that center is the world-leading information provider of content licensing solutions for corporations and academic institutions. He joined senior management at CCC in 2005, and he leads the company's product marketing and marketing communications groups. His first career, though, was in journalism. He spent 14 years as an editor, writer, and foreign correspondent at Newsweek, and he focused there on business, economics, and international affairs while working in New York, London, and Tokyo. He also became interested in the early 90s in the convergence of information and technology and the emergence of new economic models and distribution channels for content. So, following that interest, in 1995, he began his second career in the information industry. First at AT&T, then as Vice President of Content and Media Services at Infornautics, and pioneering company that introduced the e-library research service into the K-12 and consumer markets. Over the years, Bill has also helped launch several company new services for consumer and business markets, including Rogers Medical Intelligence Solutions, where he served as Senior Vice President of New Ventures from 2002 to 2004, and iCopyright, where he was Vice President of Content Services from 2000 to 2001. So as you can tell by that brief resume, he's eminently capable of discussing copyright in the 21st century. Bill.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Georgia. That was too kind. I want to thank Thompson for sponsoring this event and the News Division for hosting it. I have a real deep affinity for the News Division, having spent, and this is a fair bit of feedback here, having spent the first half of my career as a journalist, actually, and even in the newspaper industry at the very beginning at the Orlando Sentinel for a brief time before moving up to New York to join Newsweek. So it's great to be here. I also want to thank Justin Scroggs for this invitation. I was not intending to be the only panelist today. That's more of an accident of how events played out. But it's great to be here. Justin, 8 or 9 years ago, invited me to speak to this same group at an SLA meeting in Minneapolis. His silence since then for another invitation has been deafening. And so I'm hoping that I don't offend quite as much today as I apparently did at that time. So we're going to talk about copyright, and I'm going to walk around because I just can't talk unless I walk around. We're going to talk about copyright in the 21st century, and we've thrown up here some headlines that I just grabbed more or less at random off of the web, and I think it's safe to say that never before has copyright been an issue of such public concern and discussion as it is today. It is difficult to pick up a newspaper these days without seeing something around copyright, either on the front page of the business section, or somewhere in that publication. And it's going on in the consumer area, it's going on with entertainment media, it's going on with text media, it's going on in the corporate market, in the academic market. It's just happening all around us all of the time. So why is that? What in the world is going on? And I think there are a number of reasons for that. The first is the explosion of internet use and content creation. Just a few stats, and I just gathered these in the last week. 1 billion internet users worldwide, that's up from 48 million just 11 years ago. 161 exabytes. I had to look up what an exabyte is. It's 1 billion gigabytes of digital content created and copied in 2006 alone, equal to 3 million times all of the books ever written. That's in 1 year. Every minute, scientific knowledge increases by 2,000 pages, and it takes 5 years to read the new scientific material produced every 24 hours. We are overwhelmed. So if you're a little behind on your reading, give yourself a break. The increasing pace of technological and business innovation, easy-to-use software tools for creation and participation. We'll talk about this a little bit more, but the Web 2.0 is essentially about new, easy-to-use tools. That is what has made the kind of innovations that we're talking about, the popular websites that you're all using, possible. It was difficult for an individual to build a website several years ago. It's very easy now for an individual to start a blog. Increasing bandwidth, that certainly energized the multimedia space, and the rise of ad-supported business models. Google's ability to place an ad virtually anywhere targeted to the subject matter of the content has allowed for all sorts of people to start publishing content or distributing content in new ways. At the same time, the one-to-many model is breaking down. And it's being replaced by this participatory media, user-generated content, citizen journalism, whatever you're calling it, but it has been more difficult for the one-to-many media players, the traditional media players, to continue, and certainly the newspaper industry has been feeling some of that. Lastly, content and software have become inextricably linked into tools of knowledge and discovery, and we'll talk about that some more later. But Web 2.0 does some of this. Web search does a lot of it. The increasing importance of the ability to discover knowledge as opposed to just reading it. That's been a very powerful phenomenon. Just a couple of words about CCC. I suspect most of you know who we are, but we've been around for nearly 30 years. We're a not-for-profit company. We are the reproduction rights organization for the United States, and we have bilateral agreements with similar organizations in about 30 countries around the world, which allow us to license content in, to pay royalties from one country to another, and allow for this kind of free flow of information to move a little bit more easily. And we are the world's largest provider of text licensing and permission services. Our mission is very simple, to make it easy for content users to do the right thing. We have to remove the barriers. People are using content differently today than they did 10, 15, 20 years ago. Technology has enabled a lot of that. Social norms have enabled some of that. We need to keep up with that, and we need to work with the publishing industry to keep up with that. Again, to provide the market solutions that the users want. And we are very much of an intermediary between content users and the content creators. We have to play a very careful balancing act in that role. If we're leaning to one side or the other too much, the system really is not going to work. And we are always working to meet those changing needs that I just mentioned. In the corporate market, we provide services through a number of means. We have annual copyright licenses. We have 20 million employees of U.S. companies that are covered by that. We have pay-per-use services. Those are used in corporations. They're also used in the academic market for a number of different types of use that aren't covered by the annual copyright license. We have a number of desktop solutions, and if we have time near the end, I'll talk about some of those. And we do a lot of educational work. I think there are a number of copyright sessions at SLA this year. I think it reflects the genuine interest in this topic that was also reflected in some of those headlines shown at the start. Academic licensing, we're involved in providing services to more than 1,000 colleges and universities around the country. Mostly that's pay-per-use services for things like course packs, interlibrary loan, e-reserves, things of that sort. And we also work to integrate our services into other platforms so that people can do this a little more easily. And again, we're doing a lot of educational work in the academic area. So let's talk about copyright for just a minute. The purpose of it is pretty simple, to protect and promote creative and inventive works. And it's in the Constitution to promote the progress of science and the useful arts. Limited times to authors and inventors, the exclusive right to their respective writings and discoverings. It's very similar to the patent law. They're related. Patent law tends to provide a greater degree of protection for patents, but for a shorter period of time. Copyright, as you know, has been extended and extended and extended since the 1787. And we'll get to some of those terms now. But that's basically the purpose of intellectual property. And it's a fairly old concept. The Statute of Anne in England, It was essentially passed by Parliament in 1709, went into effect in 1710. It's generally viewed as the first copyright law in the world. And if you can, it's hard to read up there, but again, it's an act for the encouragement of learning by vesting the copies of printed books in the authors or purchasers of such copies during the times therein mentioned. A lot of similar language to our copyright law today. So that hasn't been changing too much. All right, what is it at the end of the day? It's a system to protect original works of authorship. Original is very important in that, fixed in any tangible medium of expression. So I gather if we are recording, in fact, today, these words are copyrighted. If we weren't recording, they wouldn't be. So that's one of the kind of interesting aspects to it. Now or later developed. So when this list was written in 1976 for the last rewrite of the U.S. Copyright Act, so that you can see there, as opposed to 1710, Congress was actually anticipating new technologies because at that time the photocopy machine, of course, was the revolutionary technology that was causing publishers fits. So we'll drill down a little bit. Protect the authors of original works of authorship. Again, it has to be original, and it is the expression of that work, not the ideas behind it. And we'll talk about that a little bit more in a sec. It covers published and unpublished works. That's fairly new. Traditionally, copyright covered only published works, and you had to register your copyright. Today, copyright is granted at the time of creation and fixation. So if someone writes the book before it's actually published, your work is copyrighted according to law. That was not always the case. It had to be published. And it grants to copyright holders the exclusive rights to reproduce, perform, distribute, translate, and publicly display their works, or, in fact, license others to do so. And the term now for individuals is 70 years after the author's death. That's gotten quite long. There's a lot of complexity to that, depending if it's a work for hire or if it's a work that the author still owns. And if you go back over time, there's a whole kind of flow chart by which you can figure out just how long a work can remain under copyright. Generally, works prior to 1923 are viewed as in the public domain, almost always. So copyright protects a lot of things, and of course, the late 18th century, they were really just talking about literary works. They didn't have photographs at that time. musical works weren't recorded in any way. They hadn't, Edison hadn't invented the phonograph. So a lot of these things were added subsequently in terms of what copyright protects: sound recordings, architectural works, computer software, obviously much more recent additions to the copyright regime. So what can you do if you own a copyright? Well, you can control who copies it, how many copies they make, how it's distributed, how it's performed in public or displayed in public, what kind of derivative works, translations, adaptations are done. You can authorize others to do any of those through licensing. You can't protect a number of things: ideas, facts, data. But you can, but with the idea, what you're protecting is the expression of the idea, the language by which you express the idea, not the idea itself. Works that haven't been fixed in the tangible form, again, if I'm not being recorded. Or very short titles and names. Gone with the Wind, you can write another book, call it Gone with the Wind if you want. You can't do that with Coke, that's a trademark. Different thing. Coke will come after you. Margaret Mitchell's estate will not. Well, they will for that other issue, yes, if you use the characters in the plot. But they lost. Some more things that can't be protected. The White Pages, basically factual work for which there's no creative element. Works created by the U.S. government are always in the public domain. That is not the case for works created by state governments or other governments around the world. Some governments, some state governments include their works in the public domain, others don't, so you need to check. Some governments make pretty good work, pretty good money off selling the copies of their laws. Or work for which the copyright has expired. Just to make a point about digital content, some people presume that digital content operates under different sets of rules from other kinds of content that have been, in fact, printed. Just because something's available on the web, well, gee, we must be able to just copy that and use it. Not the case, any more than you could for a book. So the same rules apply to digital content and analog content. Anything else up there? Music, we're hearing a lot about music with copyright. And getting back to that point of creation, an email message is protected by copyright, just like a pen and ink letter, and also from the time that it's created. So all those emails in your that you have created and sent, they're all copyrighted. So why does it matter? Well, first of all, it's the law. And as we have moved from an economy of the production and distribution of physical goods to the production and distribution of intellectual property, copyright, patents have become more important to our economic structure. So companies are paying more attention to copyright. And that's, again, part of why it's such a subject of public debate and discussion, because intellectual property is so central to our economy today. Second of all, it's the right thing to do. You don't steal physical goods, you don't steal intellectual property. And most people, I think, have understood that, but there's a lot of education going on. Some different organizations in the IP space have decided to be a little bit more aggressive about going after what they view as infringement. RIAA is one example. Publishing industry has generally not taken that kind of an approach, thankfully. But there's a great need to educate employees about copyright issues. And let's face it, without copyright, there would be no publishing. The publishing industry could not exist without the protections afforded by copyright. Think of your newspapers. If someone, the day you publish it, if someone could go copy the entire newspaper, scrape it off the website, go out and create new forms of that and essentially give them away or sell them for in a cheaper form, or maybe even bundle new advertising with that, it would be a huge challenge to any kind of a publishing industry, whether it's a book or a magazine or a newspaper or a scientific journal, anything. So it is essential to the publishing industry. There are a couple more practical reasons why people should care about copyright, because there have been some instances where folks have gotten into trouble for not respecting it. Kind of going, starting most recent, I suspect a number of people have heard about the Lowry's and Legg Mason case, 2005. Legg Mason, an investment bank, they were taking in one copy of a fairly expensive newsletter, discussed interest rate predictions, a very important topic to a lot of investment bankers, a lot of people at that bank. They were sending that thing around, posting it on the internet, doing everything they could to spread that content around the company. Meanwhile, Lowry's Reports, the publisher of that newsletter, had all kinds of licensing systems. They had site licenses and enterprise licenses. They had actually created a system for an enterprise like Legg Mason to take that content in under license and legally share it. But for some reason, the Legg Mason folks didn't catch on to that, even after a number of warnings. They were sued. $20 million judgment from the judge. There was it was settled privately after that. The word on the street is about $10 million. So that was a pretty expensive form of copyright infringement. Going back a decade, the Texaco case, you may have heard of that. That was copying by a number of researchers at Texaco, the American Geophysical Union. Obviously, these folks produce a lot of content that an oil company would find interesting. They sued Texaco, and again, they prevailed in that. Seven-figure settlement and a lot of dollars in legal fees. Going back even a little further, the Kinko's case, this really dealt with course packs in the university environment. Kinko's was just copying this stuff. They, again, were sued by Basic Books, $2 million in fees, costs, and damages. Kinko's actually got out of the course pack business for a number of years because of that. So there are some practical reasons why folks care about copyright. Just a few common misconceptions. Physical ownership of the book is not the same as owning the copyright of the book. So if I own a copy of Harry Potter, it doesn't mean I can make copies of Harry Potter and sell those. I think most people understand that pretty intuitively. We no longer have to register the copyright or, in fact, even put the copyright symbol on a work for it to be copyright protected. That was part of the change involved in the 1976 Act. Works made for hire. Most of the works produced for newspapers, the employer, not the author, is in fact the copyright owner. Attribution is not a substitute for copyright permission. So I'm going to reprint a chapter of this book in my dissertation. And goodness, just because I give them thanks for that doesn't mean that I don't have to go and get permission. And the public domain is not the same as publicly available. That's that often common misperception on the web. So fair use. This is a topic I suspect most people are struggling with. It's not clear. It's very gray. What it does essentially is recognize that certain types of use don't require permission. It's a U.S. concept. It's not a concept that exists anywhere else in the world. They have some other notions of how to protect this, so we don't really see an exact fair use application anywhere else. It's designed to allow for the use of some of copyright-protected works for a number of purposes for which permission might not be given. If I want to do a parody of something, someone might not let me actually give me permission to do that parody. But through fair use, you're able to do that. News reporting, again, hugely important for people in this room if you're, in fact, representing newspaper publishers. We have a big carve-out for fair use. And there are four factors. So when you try to figure out if something is, in fact, fair use, Congress created a little test for you. And there are four questions you need to ask yourself. What is the purpose and character of the use? What am I going to do with it? What's the nature of that copyrighted work? Is it a book of fiction? Is it a nonfiction book? Has it been in the was it published a number of years ago? Or in fact, was it just published the day before? That helps you get at some of the economic value of it. What is the amount of the or substantiality of the portion that I'm actually using? Am I using half the book? Am I using a couple hundred words from the book? And it's not always a pure mathematics test there. There's a really interesting case about a publisher using 300 words of Gerald Ford's memoirs, or in fact the Nation magazine, taking 300 words of Gerald Ford's memoirs, printing them in the Nation. It was only 300 words of a 300-page book, but they lost. Because what the Nation did was take the juiciest stuff out of that book, which was what Gerald Ford had to say about Richard Nixon's pardon. And what's the effect? This perhaps is most important. What's the effect on the market for that book? If my use is actually depriving that copyright owner of the chance to make money off the piece that I'm using, that is a really weighs quite negatively. If you're using something for which there really is very limited economic value, that's probably going to weigh in your favor. I am not going to go through any analysis of this. That really needs to be done by your own copyright attorney. Everyone needs to make their own fair use judgment. No one else can make that for you. But this is just a sense of how that works. Few examples, quotations, spontaneous or unanticipated reproduction, something you might not have time to get permission for, a parody, a summary of an address or an article. That often works with abstracts. It's kind of a carve-out that the abstract providers can use. Or just personal use in small amounts. I should also say at this point, if anyone has questions along the line, just raise your hand, stand up, shout them out, and I'm happy to try to answer some of those. Fair use in the corporate and academic environment. Most people believe that corporations, many people assume that corporations don't really have many fair use rights. They do. Generally speaking, however, I would say it's true that the academic arena has a slightly broader fair use set of rights and generally take somewhat more aggressive advantage of those. It is difficult for corporate uses of copyrighted works, however, in general. All right. So that's through the technical stuff. What do content users want? Very simply, they want convenient access to information, the ability to use and share it, not to be bound by formats and files. If I start reading a document on my computer at work in the morning and I want to finish it at home at night on my home PC, I don't want some DRM technology to make that impossible. They want reasonable and understandable pricing, and they want no hassles. So the publishers often want to protect their intellectual property, to keep some control, to be compensated. They want to produce materials that people need. That's where the economic value is created. And they want to understand how their content's being used. Now, generally, those would seem to be fairly nice balance, but as you know, there's often a bit of tension around those balancing interests. So copyright, though it is in the law, it isn't only about the law. Copyright is affected by many factors in our society. Congress reacts to some of those. Social norms drive some of those. The public interest. Technology drives a lot of change and thinking around copyright. Business models and economic incentives. New business models around ad-supported content as opposed to subscription-supported content, again, are creating some tension around copyright. And political and economic interests. The copyright term extension in the late 1990s, sometimes called the Sonny Bono Act, other people call it the Disney Act, there was a strong economic interest there from Hollywood in terms of extending copyrights. So the law ultimately reflects some societal balancing of all of these, and that tends to get hashed out in Washington. All right, now on to the fun part. Content is changing. Content is starting to come in many, many new forms. Wikipedia. 30,000 volunteers have created an encyclopedia far larger than the Encyclopedia Britannica in just a few years. They are adding new entries at an amazing pace. And how many people use Wikipedia? All right, enough said. It's a pretty big challenge for Encyclopedia Britannica. Encyclopedia of Life. This was announced last month. The Encyclopedia of Life is an effort coordinated by a number of prominent scientists, Edward O. Wilson at Harvard, the biologist, one of them, to create an encyclopedia of the 1.8 million species of plants and animals and insects and other species on the planet that will be completely open and completely free. Now, I'm the publisher of an encyclopedia about biological species. I'm going to start thinking about my business model right away. This is going to be very high quality content. It'll take 10 years, they estimate, to complete this, but it's going to be an amazing resource for society, for education, for scientific discovery. It'll be a living resource. It'll be added to on a continual basis. The Yeti crab, which is this strange-looking creature up here. It was only recently discovered off the coast of Easter Island in the South Pacific. So it could take an encyclopedia, again, another reprinting of an encyclopedia, years to actually capture this kind of information. So this will be a living and breathing encyclopedia of life. Meantime, as we all know, technology makes the sharing of content very easy today. So in preparation for today, last week I was doing a little research and I Googled the words copyright and Google to see what I could find. And one of the things I found was this press release from the Authors Guild, nearly 2 years old now, where they're announcing that they're suing Google over the Google Book Search project on behalf of authors. Now, up in the right-hand corner of the browser, there's this little Share This icon just to the right of the search bar. This is a little application that I downloaded just to play around with it. And so I clicked it, And this was the first time I did this. So you're experiencing this basically the same way I experienced this. Kind of the background grayed out, and this little window popped up, and it said, okay, what's the subject? And it filled in the headline that it had grabbed from the original piece, and said, gave me a little message, check this out. I could have filled that out. And I could fill in there who I wanted to send it to, as many emails as I liked. A little like this is an email to a friend feature that's on a lot of websites. I could also post it to my MySpace page or my Facebook page. I don't do that much, but I could do that. So I send it to myself, and here's how it came in. So this is my inbox. So in addition to the headline and the link, there's actually a thumbnail of the article as it appeared on the web, and the ability, once again, to share this or send it to my MySpace page or my Facebook page. Now, this is viral distribution, you know, really supercharged. And people are using this stuff. Now, in this case, it's a link. So links are generally okay. Although there's this thumbnail here. Some people think, well, thumbnails, maybe that's actually a copying of the article. Recent court case just a couple of weeks ago. I won't say too much about it because it involves adult content. But it was the so-called Perfect 10 case. Perfect 10 was a producer of adult photos, and they had them out on the web. And Google, of course, which is just kind of looking at everything on the web, almost without any discrimination, was taking that and putting little thumbnails on search result pages. And the folks at Perfect 10 said, no, that's a copying of our original works. And so they sued them. And the district court judge, in fact, found generally, there's some complication here, but generally in favor of Perfect 10 and said, nah, Google, you really can't do that. The Ninth Circuit in California a couple of weeks ago reversed that opinion and said, yeah, Google, that's fair use. Google, I'll just, a little aside here about Google, the reason that Google is involved in so many of the copyright cases that are being discussed today is that Google's business depends on fair use. And Google, this is a perhaps unique time where a large, well-funded company has decided to make a stand and invest a lot of resources in pursuing a fair use argument, which is essentially generally the kind of use that end users are pushing for. But in this case, we have a large company pushing the fair use side. Typically, large companies are defending the views of the rights holder. So it's a kind of an interesting time. All right. So 5.5 months ago, Time magazine named every one of you the person of the year. And I'm sure you called your mother and patted yourself on the back. So I also suspect that a lot of people in America wondered what in the world this was about. Now, many of you probably didn't wonder that because you're a bit more conversant with some of these technologies. But let's look at what it really was about. It was about this. This is a chart from Technorati, which is a blog search engine. And what it shows is that in March of 2003 to March of 2007, it's the rise of the number of blogs that exist. And it's gone from nearly zero to more than 70 million blogs in those 4 years. And 120,000 blogs are created every day. Now, I actually took out a calculator, and that's more than one per second. More than one blog per second is created around the world. So the growth, that's a true hockey stick, right? That's what you want to see if you're starting a new company. In this case, of course, it only reflects the growth of the blogs. And many tools, Web 2.0 tools, to help you organize this blog information through RSS feeds so that you can make sense of this all and track many, many blogs. Anybody in here have an RSS reader or feed or trying to track RSS feeds? I suspect more of you will over time. This is just a small sampling of the Web 2.0 universe. I've seen another version of this where there are hundreds of these icons. Again, it's about easy-to-use tools that can be quickly developed and deployed that put control in the hands of the user around content. It's a shot across the bow for a lot of traditional content providers. This is my blog reader, Blog Lines, and so there are a lot of blogs, and I'm behind on my blog reading. And so here is one blog, IP Central Weblog. And so here's my RSS feed of that, and I can go read those items. And so the question really comes up, well, what is this blogger doing here? What are they expecting? What's their expectation when they're blogging? Are they trying to make money? Do they actually think that that there's a future in that? And I think that the rise of blogs starts to raise some very interesting questions. Oh, the photo didn't show up. There's a photo of Samuel Johnson there. He's a stern-looking man. But Samuel Johnson, who was a writer and lexicographer in 18th century Britain, had a very clear view about why people write. No man but a blockhead ever wrote except for money. He was the guy that Boswell followed around and wrote the biography of. So I think that the view of authorship and creation has actually changed quite a bit. People are not necessarily creating for money anymore. They're creating for a lot of reasons. They're creating, and we got a little problem on this, advertisements for myself. This is a picture of a blog by a man named Mark Potts. If it was there, it would be a picture of a blog. Mark Potts was a journalist at the Washington Post for many years. He left the Washington Post. He now blogs. You can go read his writings for free. So why does Mark do this? Well, Mark consults for media companies, online and offline media companies. His blog is an advertisement for himself. It's his way of being known. He's not trying to make money off his blog. He wants people to read the blog. He wants people to forward the blog. He wants that kind of notoriety and attention. So again, creativity is starting to take very different forms, and how people earn livings off their creativity is also taking some different forms. And that gives rise to a clash of cultures. And YouTube is a pretty good place where you can see that clash of cultures playing out. Viacom sues Google and YouTube. Google's now the owner of YouTube, for $1 billion. Meanwhile, lots of people are throwing their own creations up on YouTube and using that platform for entertainment, to promote themselves, or just, you know, just for kicks. Now, many of these Web 2.0 applications, these new interesting applications, unfortunately, they tend to infringe on the rights of some stakeholder in this process, often another copyright owner or rights holder. Again, part of the tension that's driving all of this interest. Now, this is a great site called Wolfgang's Vault, and this is a case study in kind of this collision of copyright and of values. I see someone nodding there who's probably been to Wolfgang's Vault. Wolfgang, in this case, is Bill Graham. Bill Graham was the concert and music impresario in San Francisco and New York in the 60s. If you went to a concert in San Francisco at the Fillmore East or West or Fillmore East in New York or at Winterland in San Francisco, you were going to a Bill Graham-produced concert. His birth name was Wolfgang. He was born in Berlin back in the 30s. Bill Graham died in a helicopter crash in 1991, and about a decade later, someone bought essentially the archive that Bill Graham had left behind. Bill Graham kept everything. And in this archive, which is Wolfgang's Vault, as it's now been called, were all sorts of things. There were the wonderful psychedelic posters from the concerts back in the 60s, T-shirts, tickets, ticket stubs, photographs of those concerts, and 5,000 or more recordings of these concerts. So it took a number of months just to go through all of this stuff and figure out what's there. It was a great job for a librarian. Take stock of what they had. So that's how they came up with these 5,000 concerts. Pretty high quality recordings. And they were all sitting there. So they said, well, let's just put this stuff on the web. People are going to love this. So, okay, they create a site called Wolfgang's Vault, and you can buy T-shirts. You can buy vintage T-shirts or reproduction T-shirts, or you can buy the old posters. You can buy all sorts of stuff. Or you could go on at the beginning, stream the concerts, listen to the concerts. Now you can actually buy the concerts. I think it's $9.95 or something, and you can download the file of the concert. So if you're interested in Leonard Skinner at Cardiff Castle in 1975, go to Wolfgang's Vault and you can hear about it. Now you'll notice up in the right-hand corner what performers are paid. a few artists didn't take kindly to this. I think it was the dead Leonard Skinner or something, and Carlos Santana, and anyway, a couple of artists or artist estates decided to sue, not surprisingly, and said, wait a minute, this is our stuff. This is not yours. You happen to own the recording, but we own the copyright, and so you can't just do this without paying us. So after this suit, they obviously negotiated something, and in fact, when you click and find out what performers are paid, you find that they're now cutting them in pretty well. I was interested in this and first became aware of this because of this Bruce Springsteen concert from December 15th, 1978, and I was at that concert, and I had bought a few years later a terrible quality bootleg, you know, vinyl LP of that concert, which I could barely listen to. And years later, decades later, suddenly I'm able to listen to a high quality audio rendition of that concert. It was like being there. So what should Bruce Springsteen think about this? Should he care? Is this depriving him of some economic value? Could he sell that? Could his record label sell that? So Bruce, to my knowledge, hasn't sued, but he's now getting cut in on some of the revenues there. So I show this only because I think it's a really interesting case of how copyright and the new technologies of distribution and digitization kind of and knowledge discovery, you could use Google or other tools to find these concerts, how it all kind of comes together and creates a very interesting set of issues. So because of this, a number of these content creators, especially in the blogging community, have decided to look to some alternatives because they want their content to be shared. So they've started to look at Creative Commons is one example of things they're looking at. Creative Commons was started in really out of the Stanford community by Larry Lessig in 2002. And this chart is, again, to show in that hockey stick way the growth of Creative Commons licenses that are attached to pieces of content out there. And it went, of course, from zero in 2003 because it had just launched, to more than 140 million today distinct pieces of content that have been attached to Creative Commons licenses. So it's an alternative. It is not a giving away of all rights because of the way the Constitution works. These people do have copyright, but they have decided because their own notion of how they want their content to move, they really want it to move around. They want some of the freedoms that a Creative Commons license conveys. So they've decided to adopt that. It's just an alternative approach, and I think it's very appropriate for certain types of content where the creator of that content wants it to be shared. So the long tail. This is the third kind of hockey stick chart we've seen. Everybody here familiar with the long tail concept? Hands, have you heard of the long tail? So the long tail is a concept. Chris Anderson, who's the editor of Wired magazine, wrote a piece back in October of 04 in Wired talking about the long tail, and he subsequently turned it into a book. And what it really, the point it really makes is that in the digital world, where the cost of storing content, as opposed to a physical store where you can only kind of keep so many items on the shelves of your store, in a digital world, you can keep all the items kind of on the store shelves. Amazon can keep all the books or all the CDs on their shelves. And so when that fact changes the economics of the business, and so suddenly, yes, you'll still have your hits, but you'll get a lot of economic value from the albums that are, you know, the millionth selling album or the 500,000th selling album. And in fact, there are a lot of interesting stats to show how often, in fact, that long tail of content is purchased. So again, part of that changing economics and how it relates to copyright. So this is my attempt to explain some of what's going on here. And this is the long view, because we go back to 1400. Essentially, in the Middle Ages, if you wanted to reproduce content, it was the job of monks operating kind of painstakingly with candlelight and some daylight to make copies of things. So a lot of the value of the piece of content and the ability to distribute that content was related to the means of production and distribution. You had the content, but boy, a lot of work and value was involved in the reproduction of that content. Now, Gutenberg came along in around 1450 and changed that a little bit because the printing press made the reproduction of content suddenly more efficient. And technology, up until very recently, has tended to have the effect of making the distribution of the content more efficient. And when you make things more efficient, what it has really allowed is for the content itself to represent a greater share of the value of the product. And so the Industrial Revolution, suddenly you could ship newspapers around and by train, and you could, again, you could just vastly increase the efficiency of distribution. And so by 1900, you could have newspapers that were 2 or 3 cents, a far cry from the kind of the monk-like production of a number of centuries before. But something's happened with the web. Yes, it's made distribution more efficient, but it is now value-added distribution. It's changed the game in a very, very significant way. Now the tools are helping you find the content. They're helping you analyze the content. They're helping you make sense of the content. The Web 2.0 tools enable you to take content from a variety of forms and bring it together in one place. So suddenly, the balance is shifting a little bit. The distributors are bringing a little bit more to the table. Google's bringing more to the table. The kinds of technologies, and there are a couple of companies on the exhibit floor that are doing some fascinating things with content, are also adding value to the content. So this is a bit of concern to some traditional rights holders because some of the value is going away, and it's going away to these companies that I don't necessarily understand very well. They're run by 24-year-old guys in Palo Alto. Where this is going to go, I don't know. But it's a powerful, powerful phenomenon. It certainly relates to some of the challenges that we're seeing in the traditional publishing industry or the traditional media industry. So this is the phenomenon that is kind of driving people nuts, whether it's at a Hollywood studio or a network or a newspaper or a magazine or a scientific journal. So that's kind of the big effect. Value-added distribution. There's an example out here of a company that that takes pieces of content and they fingerprint them. They call it fingerprinting the content. And what they're able to do is to extract the ideas and concepts from massive amounts of content so that scientists can start understanding the linkages between pieces of content and starting to see patterns. So remember that first slide where I think it takes 5 years to read the scientific content that's published in 24 hours. It's tools that will help people understand that. We can't read any faster than we can read today, but tools will enable us to read. So that's where software and content comes together, and that's where value-added distribution starts to change the game. Remember when I saw that 6-8 months ago, just feeling incredibly moved by that. It's incredibly powerful. He's a professor of anthropology. Think about that. How societies evolve. So what lies ahead? More of the same. Our environment will become increasingly information rich. Living documents, Wikipedia, Encyclopedia of Life, will replace static ones. Participation and communication will be increasingly central to the content experience, and new tools and technologies will continue to disrupt the status quo with astonishing frequency. So I'm going to come back to the prosaic, or the kind of common a little bit here, and talk about, in a corporate environment, how this plays out, because we have, are there any questions at this point? Does anybody want to ask any questions about any of this? No? Okay. So at the within the corporate enterprise, there's a lot of emphasis on collaboration these days. Links between collaboration and innovation are pretty well documented. Companies are spending a lot of money on collaboration tools and technologies. They're spending a lot of money on content, and people are using it. They're reading it, and they're sharing it. 89% of knowledge workers sharing documents with colleagues on a weekly basis. And believe me, they're not stopping to ask for permission every time. So there's a big copyright challenge there. People are starting their search on the open web. Google is where they start their research, by and large. I know you're spending a lot of money on databases in a lot of cases, but they're probably starting with Google and maybe coming to the databases later. 60% believe it's just fine to share free information from the open web or from print sources. One of those misconceptions before, just because it's available for free doesn't mean you can do whatever you want to with it. 30% think it's just fine to share information they actually pay for. And a lot of them purchase information independently, and they think it's okay to share that as well. So a lot of education needs to be done. So we've actually taken one approach, and because I'm not here to sell a product. I just want to, because there are a lot of ways that we as a society and how businesses and publishers and rights holders or intermediaries like CCC are going to have to try to bridge this gap between people using content like crazy and the people who are producing that content and aren't so sure they want people using it like crazy, or at least without, you know, some rules around that. So our approach to this has been to create a service and product we call RightSphere, and it really just is helping people get a very simple answer. Well, what can I do? I'm not a copyright expert. I'm not a lawyer. I'm looking at a piece of content. I want to share this content, and this is probably the content that a lot of your organizations are creating. So how can I get the answer very quickly so that I don't have to kind of stop what I'm doing, call the library, try to describe to them what I'm doing, and have them look up in their contract database what rights come with that contract and call me back hours or days later with the answer to that question? And companies are spending that money they're spending is on many, many different content licenses, dozens, scores of licenses, all with different rights embedded in them. Some allow you to share it across the enterprise. Some allow you to share it within your department or within your location. Some don't allow you to share it at all. So people need to understand how to manage and organize these rights and, at the same time, maybe raise a little bit of awareness. People do want to do the right thing. I firmly believe that, if they know what the right thing to do is. But their current options, again, if they want to do the right thing, they can contact the intermediary, again, call the library and wait. You can just wing it. Share it, don't ask permission, hope for the best. You can pay for duplicate originals because you don't know that the person down the hall or in the next department or in another location has already bought that content and given, and that your company in fact has rights to that content. Well, you have no way of knowing that today, so you might just keep paying and paying again for the same content. Or you don't share it at all, and that's clearly not acceptable. So our customers were saying, gee, help us make sense of this. Give us some tools to understand what all these rights are so that we can, you know, get our people collaborating more and get them the answer that applies to them. You know, they're not going to know that their department has a subscription to this publication, but that the other department doesn't and they can't send it to that person. Give them the information how it applies to them. So we've created a tool, and I'll just take you through a couple of very quick screenshots, because it is just one answer to this dilemma of how to balance collaboration and with some sensitivity to copyright. So if I'm looking at Nature, prestigious science publication, and I'll click my RightSphere icon, I'm going to assume here that I'm working for a company that has RightSphere. In my case, I do. I'll click that, and a window is going to pop up, and it's going to say, well, gee, you're looking at Nature. We get that. We have a number of types of use. You can't read these, but you want to email it, or do you want to put it on a shared network drive, or do you want to make some photocopies, or do you want to put it on your intranet site, or, you know, what do you want to do with this thing? How do you want to share it? Who do you want to see it? So there are types of use, and then you can say, well, you know, gee, what I want to do is I want to email this to some of my coworkers, and there's a little green check mark, and it says, well, okay, confirm your permission, and I confirm the permission, and your permission is granted. No legalistic language around permissions and licenses. Just, yeah, go ahead. Your permission is granted. Thanks for verifying your rights. Go ahead. And you can print out a copy of that if you want. So it's one very easy way to get people involved. At CCC, we're really getting back to that. When I talked about our mission, making it easy for people to do the right thing, we've just launched a new we've had copyright.com for a long time, but we've redesigned it and relaunched it, and we're trying to make it, again, easier. We've simplified commerce flows, and we've put more educational material in there, and we're doing a lot of things just to get the speed bumps and the hassles out of the way of people sharing content. And so once again, you can come in, and you can now see, and I don't know if there are many people here who use copyright.com frequently, but if you do or if you have, the changes here are really pretty astonishing, because we've made it a lot easier. So again, you can see the types of use that might be available to you or that you can purchase if you feel that you need to purchase some uses. Now, RightsLink is another way of doing it. There's some other companies that do similar things. And this is a way for a publication, through some technology that it can employ with us in this case, to allow for the readers of a publication to purchase licenses or permissions to the content that they happen to be reading at the time. So we work with the Wall Street Journal and the New York Times and USA Today and a lot of scientific publishers. And the idea here is that I'm on the open web, you're on the open web, you're reading this story, and again, you want to do something with it. You might want to order some reprints. You might want to buy permission to put it on your company's intranet site so that all the employees of the company, you might want to buy a 1,000 reprints so that you can pass them out at the next SLA show. So you click on that, and I'll just take you very quickly through this workflow. You can kind of choose your type of use, and you can enter how many copies you want to make, and you can check on the price for that, and boom, you can accept the order. Accept the terms of conditions, review the order, and you're on your way. So I think a lot of publishers, many, many publishers, are starting to adopt some of these tools to allow them to license content from their own websites. Because it's great to have free content. A lot of people have kind of tuned their business models so that people can come to their websites, view the content, you're getting some ad impressions, and that's a nice business model, but it doesn't mean that you want to give everything away forever. You still want to reserve certain rights for certain uses of your content, and you want to be able to sell that. You want to make it easy for people to buy it. So it works for copies, email, republishing rights, web postings, it's print or digital, full text or granular. O'Reilly Media, very innovative publishing company out in California. They produce a lot of books on software and kind of technology-oriented books. Has just implemented RightSphere on a very granular way, and they're actually selling content at the paragraph level or the chart level or a piece of computer code that they will show in one of their books. They're going to give a tip because these are often computer programmers who are buying O'Reilly books, and you can, if they're doing this online, you can license a piece of code that you can then use in your application. So there are all sorts of ways you can use this kind of technology. And it works 24/7 because you just put it up on the web and you no longer have to people, you know, they're no longer calling your rights and permissions department for things that could well be really quite automated. There will always be a few things that you want a human being to deal with, but the vast majority of requests that come in, you can automate those. So for content users, it's great because they can, you know, 24/7, they can get their quotes, they can transact, they can buy, they can comply with copyright law, and they can get the permissions they need. And for copyright holders, it's great because it's a new channel for selling your content. So again, there are a lot of tools out there that I think are now available to publishers that also meet the needs of content users. And lastly, we are also integrating our services into all sorts of other platforms because we know that people aren't always going to come to copyright.com. They're in another platform. They're maybe in a service that's allowing them to manage their interlibrary loans. And so, well, I'm just going to buy my interlibrary loan permission right there within that application or an e-reserve or a course pack or something like that. So in our effort, again, to just make it easy for people to do the right thing, we'll connect with all sorts of people. And these are some of the partners that we've connected with. A lot of them in the academic space. And that's it. That's the all the stuff that I wanted to show. But I'm hoping that there'll be some questions, and there already is a question. We have a mic up here, or if you really want to shout it out, I'll repeat it. Well, the rough edges around fair use are, you know, pretty hard to discern sometimes. I think if it involves taking something and in some verbatim way copying the thing and putting it and redistributing it, whether it's on a website or making physical copies of it, that becomes an act that is I'd say, you know, a permissible act. You need to seek permission and a license to do that. It doesn't mean you have to pay money. It could be for free, but you still need to get permission. Sorry? But they're putting it on the paper's website? No, I would say that doesn't sound too good. I mean, if they're just taking another photograph that someone has taken and owns the right to, and they're grabbing it off a website and putting it in their newspaper, I think they're going to have a problem. If that's it, I mean. Okay. Yeah, that's good. Talk to your lawyer about some fair use analysis of that. Oh, that question is about what if you use it in a collage? So you take some photographs, illustrations, you know, other kinds of artwork, and you mash it up and you make something look really nice. Do you need to get permission for that? And I think the answer is that you probably want to talk to your lawyer about some fair use analysis. If you're taking one photograph and simply reproducing that, you clearly have to get some permission to do that. Mm-hmm. No selection. You're cover to cover complete. No creativity. So lawyers who earn far more than I do an hour are going to have a fun time with that one. Absolutely. I don't have an answer for you, but I can see why people are engaged in that question. Absolutely. Yeah, now if you were doing something very selective, if you were creating an online sort of program and you were just selectively taking pieces of public domain information and creating some, using that kind of creative selective process, that changes the answer to that question, whatever the answer is. And I can't predict what the answer is, but I suspect that you're going to be on far firmer ground. If you have done some creative selection and then someone copies that, you're going to have a much better claim on them than if you've just done complete wall-to-wall copying of public domain. So who's the copyright cop? Who's the copyright cop and what's the percentage of compliance going on out there? We're not the copyright cop. I think publishers are in some cases their own copyright cops. There are certainly publishers out there who are hiring companies that have image or text recognition software combined with some web spidering technologies. And so they'll go off there in search of documents or images that are residing on some other server, perhaps in an unpermissioned way. And the goal there is not necessarily to have those people take it down, but to get some license from those people. So publishers are doing some of that work. SIA is doing some of that work. But there's a sign, isn't it? So you've been saying at the microphone. Is there a light switch back there anywhere? Oh, okay. There we go. Thank you, Justin. Okay. Okay. You are with what kind of an enterprise or a company or? So when you the question, they're doing some interesting things about limiting. This is e-journal articles to 5 copies. Is that through some DRM technology or is that just?
No, it's just the license.
It's just the license, and people are supposed to know that they're the 4th, and the next person is the 5th, and
yes. but
I might be the 6th, so I shouldn't do it. That's.
The librarians know it, and we tell.
You do. Okay. All right. So. So then the question is, you know, is there some DRM kind of technological solution that can gate this, restrict copying, measure copying? There are, those technologies exist. They are often not very user-friendly, and I think there has been a fairly negative reaction, by and large, to a lot of those technological approaches. Now, there are certainly some instances where you have publishers of very high-value content, the $5,000 research report, and they'll often put that into some kind of a DRM container so that maybe it can be just printed out once or can't be printed out at all or something. And you can certainly see the thinking that goes into making that type of a decision, and it's kind of hard to criticize. But I think generally the less DRM, the better, and other kinds of licensing policies that would allow for not 5, because who's to say the 6th person doesn't need it just as much as the 1st? It's kind of the 1st person to the party. You know, why should they actually have the privilege of seeing that document, but not the 6th person to the party? Yeah, there are people who are trying to do those things, and DRM. Talk to a lot of people; they'll just say DRM is dead because it puts a pretty big barrier in there, and when the goal is to make it easy for people to share and collaborate, I think the real ultimate solution is around ways that allow everybody who needs to see a document to see a document, and to do that through the, you know, kind of forward-thinking licensing contracts and policies and tools that can help people understand what they can do. Yes, ma'am. Well, it sounds like what you're saying is that your electronic subscriptions are allowing them access. So the access is great. That's a great policy. Oh yeah, a link is terrific, and especially if you're in an academic institution where essentially all the students or everyone in that has access to the same databases. So if you send a link, nobody's going to be locked out because they're not part of the, you know, they don't have access. So as long as you're giving people access, links are a wonderful way to share content without any.
One of the things you do is you show them those tools where sure. If you send a link, it actually lets the person have access.
Yeah.
That sells that person's product.
Mm-hmm. Sure. Yes. It's WESCH, I believe. It's available on YouTube. You can find it around the web. It was a much discussed and passed around video, kind of within a certain subculture, 6-8 months ago. So the question is. If you, in the case of the Wall Street Journal, and there's a rights rights link icon there or link, and you can go in there and buy certain things. Well, what if somebody doesn't do that? So there, it is a good faith system. Again, it is trusting people to do the right thing. So if I, as the I'm working for a company, we've got a trade show coming up, and the Wall Street Journal's just written a piece about my company that just, you know. Great review of a new product. Walt Mossberg's just said we're terrific, and I want 1,000 copies because that trade show's coming up. I can go through RightsLink or through the Wall Street Journal. I can do it through proper channels and get my 1,000 professional reprints and pay the freight for that. Or, you know, there have been companies that'll go in and just, you know, kind of grab it and mock something up and make 1,000 copies and hand it out at the trade show. That is clearly a violation of copyright, and I think, fortunately, by this time, most companies know that. Marketing departments that are generally asked to provide reprints for things like this, those folks know that stuff. It's the odd company, I think, that doesn't get it. But that's not to say some people don't do some things that get them into trouble. Yes? Well, a whole lot of questions embedded in that question. I mean, do you own the rights to the photograph, or was the photographer a freelance photographer and you bought a... It was a staff photographer? I mean, there's nothing wrong with that. I mean, you as the rights holder can do almost anything you want. I mean, you can be as permissive as you want to be. And a lot of publishers and rights holders do give away a lot of free permissions. We see this in the academic world all the time where they'll charge corporations for certain uses. But if a professor wants to put something in a course pack, they'll let him or her do that, and they won't even ask for compensation. And that's an okay approach. Nobody says it has to be a monetary transaction. The permission could be a non-monetary a transaction. It could be for free, but I think the act of permission is valuable. The situation, you know, I it would be hard for me to give you a specific answer to that, but it's an interesting one. That's been a good photograph. Yes? So I'm not quite understanding. Is this something this person had written?
No, he did not write. He reviewed it for someone else.
It was a peer review?
Correct.
Okay, it's
and
a peer review. So if, I mean, the peer review process is really something that a publisher has certainly authorized for copies to be made of a draft so that people can comment and offer their opinions and suggestions and critiques.
Well, it is an actual download from the Internet.
So I'm not sure what the end result was. He trying to publish the annotated? Yeah, I don't know. I'd have to know more to give you an answer on that. Yeah, the tricky one. Yes. Oh. Well, it's an archiving, a digital archiving issue, which is a big issue of, you know, a whole other.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know the copyright implication of that. Yes. Well, there are probably some terms and conditions somewhere around there, where they're providing the content to, and maybe even terms and conditions of your reciprocal agreements as organizations, and the terms under which they're giving you access even to that one copy. So it's probably almost more of a licensing issue than a, I mean, it's a licensing issue as well as a copyright issue. So the answer may be in the license, or the terms of access that they've given you through your username and password. Just because you have a username and password access doesn't mean you can take that content. That was the people who pay for content and then think they can just copy it. So you'd have to look into the terms of use of your access agreement into that database and whether it allows you to redistribute it within your organization or externally, and those are two different questions. They don't always tell you. Yes? So that I believe that that's still an unresolved question. I'm not a copyright attorney, but there I know at one point in time there were conflicting court decisions around National Geographic created the CD set of the complete history of National Geographic, and they were sued to Ticini-like case. And I believe two different courts came to different conclusions on that, and I honestly don't know where that stands. But there's some good lawyers who could help you with that one. This issue's the New Yorker a couple of years ago came out with a complete New Yorker, and they by design hobbled the technological capability of that set in terms of its ability to search, and because of some copyright concerns. So they had to do some. They had essentially the technology was right there. They had to turn some things off because they felt in their own analysis that having that those added bits in there ran afoul of some of these. Yeah, there were a few things involved. So you don't have the digital agreement, right? Right. Okay. So, yeah. I mean, it sounds like a bad customer experience, first of all, and it may be more related to that than the terms of their license. It's hard for me to know. That could have been a technical snafu, where for some reason they just weren't passing that intelligence along with the link that's a link that someone else can open. It gets back to a little bit of that earlier question about DRM, right? Suddenly, some form of DRM that was injected into that workflow wasn't working very well. And that's certainly a cause of some frustration. Yes. Yeah. So I can't enter into a sales negotiation here. It's a new product that we think has some really, really good value, and we've done a lot of research on where we think that value lies. Ultimately, the market's going to tell us about, market always dictates price. You know, we don't control price. And so if a whole bunch of people are buying it, the price will, be at that price, and if no one buys it, no one, then the price will probably come down. So far, thankfully, that's not the case. Some people are buying it. And might we at some time, and I won't make any product predictions here, create other versions of it that might allow people to kind of access that type of a service with various levels of functionality? I think a lot of companies look at that kind of stratification of products. So I certainly can't make any promises about the price of a product we've just introduced within the last year. But I certainly hear you, and I appreciate that input. It's valuable to us. Yeah, we are. We are. But it cost a lot to build. It cost us a lot of money to build. We don't. There's no equity. There are no stock options. We are a not-for-profit company, absolutely. But that doesn't mean everything's given away or free. Yeah. Thank you for that. How are we doing? Yes. Okay. Sure. We had publications all the time, and yours is a particularly interesting and challenging area because there has been such consolidation over time in legal publishing. And so though we are a not-for-profit, and it doesn't mean we don't have competition. In some cases, we compete with the publishers who we also represent, and publishers try to monetize content through different channels in different ways. And so I think that legal content has been somewhat challenging for us over time. There's a lot of other content that law firms obviously do take advantage of, but some of those specific legal databases and content has been a challenge for us, not for lack of trying on our part to include those. So thank you. So I think that's it. Thank you very much. Appreciate it.
And if anybody has any more questions for Bill,
I'll be up here for a couple of minutes. Sure.
A few minutes, okay? One-on-one. Thank you. That was very good.
You're welcome. Appreciate Thank that. You.
Beyond the Book is an educational presentation of the not-for-profit Copyright Clearance Center, with conferences and seminars featuring leading authors and editors, publishing analysts, and information technology specialists. Beyond the Book is the premier source for knowledge on the latest business issues facing today's dynamic publishing industry, from initial research to final publication and beyond.